Even though Roger Ebert is gone, he's not been forgotten, especially by movie lovers everywhere, his family and his wife, Chaz.
Not only do I hear his voice in my head, sometimes I turn my head to look next to me, and I expect to see him sitting there.
I'm Jeff Bosser, and this hour on Focus, I'll talk with Chaz Ebert and director Steve James about the new film Life Itself, which is based on Ebert's 2011 memoir of the same title and will open the annual Ebert Fest on Wednesday. I'll talk with them about the vision for the film and about how that all changed once Roger's health began to decline.
Roger had been out in public and been very brave about letting people see him. But there's a difference between Roger appearing in public at an event and Roger in a hospital bed.
That's coming up on Focus after this hour's news. Good morning, I'm Jeff Bossert. Welcome to Focus. In 1994, a little-known documentary called Hoop Dreams premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. It may have gone unnoticed if not for critics like Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, who championed the efforts of the film's director, Steve James. 20 years later, it's James who has now taken notice of Ebert's work. His newest film, a documentary called Life Itself, is based on Ebert's 2011 memoir of the same title.
We all are born with a certain package. We are who we are. Where we were born, who we were born as, how we were raised. We're kind of stuck inside that person. And the purpose of civilization and growth is to be able to reach out and empathize a little bit with other people. And for me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy. It lets you understand a little bit more about different hopes, aspirations, dreams, and fears. It helps us to identify with the people who are sharing this journey with us.
Life Itself makes its local premiere Wednesday at this year's annual Ebert Fest Film Festival in Champaign. We just heard a clip from the film's opening scene. James says the film is not what he and others originally envisioned for the project, in part due to Roger's death last April. I spoke with James recently about the film. He told me Steven Zalian, a screenwriter who wrote Schindler's List, among others, approached him about a year ago with the idea.
I knew, you know, or thought I knew quite a bit about Roger as a professional, you know, critic, film critic, because I'd read a lot of his reviews over the years. I'd watched him on TV back, you know, when the show even first started. I tuned in fairly early in that. But I really didn't know his story of his life, which was in many ways both the most surprising thing about the memoir and also the thing that made me want to actually do the movie.
Going back to when you first read the memoir, did you approach Roger or did he come to you?
No, actually, Steve Zalian, through Garrett, his producing partner, approached Roger. They initially, you know, sent an inquiry, I think, saying that they had an interest in this. And, you know, Roger's agent said, you know, it sounded intriguing. And then when Garrett came back to the agent and to Roger and Chaz through them and said, what do you think about Steve James to direct it? You know, they were positive, but what was interesting about that is that Roger, at that point, when it appeared that this, you know, actually could and might happen, he wanted to know, like, just exactly why, you know, we thought a documentary would be an interesting thing to do. And that began a couple of back and forth between Roger and me about what I envisioned for the film, which then led to a meeting with Roger and Chaz, where we talked a bit about, like, why I wanted to do the movie and how I sort of envisioned it. And Roger, you know, liked what he heard, and so, of course, we made the film. But I think his initial thought, and I think he's even quoted somewhere saying this, was, you know, I wasn't quite sure why anyone would want to turn it into a documentary.
Some people may have been concerned, and maybe that Roger felt the same way, that this ended up being a hagiography or a case for sainthood for Ebert, and this film is not that.
Thank you. I was determined that it not be that. And in some ways, I took my cue, certainly from the memoir. You know, I think Roger speaks very candidly about a lot of things in his life in the memoir, about his drinking days, about alcoholism, about, you know, his love life and his struggles growing up as well. And so, you know, I think the candor of his memoir, you know, translated well to the film. And I was determined not to do that. I mean, frankly, I wouldn't have done the film if I didn't admire Roger. You know, I had admiration for him before I read the memoir. I had, you know, greater admiration in a way for him afterwards. But part of that was because of, you know, the way in which he viewed his own life and the way in which he grew through his life. And he recognized that and writes about that. And so I, you know, felt it was very important to have a film that was equally candid. And to his credit and Chaz's credit, you know, when I would reach out to various people to interview that are in the movie, usually the first overture was made by Roger and Chaz to kind of say, you know, Steve James is doing this film, want to, you know, just introduce you to him. And they always said, and please, you know, please cooperate if you can, and be candid. That was in every email to every single subject that we interviewed. And they meant it. And I think the people that we interviewed, many of them were very close to Roger and Chaz. They took it to heart, and I think they, you know, I really appreciated their candor.
You did your share of narration in this film, and when shortly after it opens, the first thing we hear you say is you set out to make this movie 5 months before Ebert's death, and his deteriorating health changed a lot about the movie. Can you talk about how?
Yeah, because when we started out, I had every intention of filming Roger in the present, with the idea that that part of the story would show just how vibrant and active he remains, despite all he's been through. You know, that he was still going to screenings, he was still attending awards events, even festivals, and he was throwing dinner parties. you know, he was living a very, very active life, and I felt that that would be a really great thing to show his sort of unfolding life in the present, and then off of that springboard to the past, which is something he kind of, you know, he pretty much does in the memoir too. He comes back and forth between his life in the present and his past. So I love that idea. When we started, of course, had no idea that he would, within 4 months, he would be gone. And of course, so that changed the film. And so the film, you know, of course, part of what this film is about the way someone dies. And the way in which Roger lived those last 4 months, as I observed and filmed, was, I thought, moving and courageous, and really captured a lot of the qualities that I had hoped to capture anyway, which is, here's a guy that continues to work, continues to live his life, continues to be engaged, has a great sense of humor, and will and determination. I mean, all of those things were there, I think, in those last 4 months, even though, you know, he passed away before we could finish the film.
In those last couple of months, what was it like to be around him and Chaz while you were filming?
It was at times great, and then it was at times, you know, it was hard, because you could see how hard it was on them, and you could see how hard it was on Chaz. You know, Chaz had been, and Roger had both been down this road in a way before, you know, on several occasions. And there had been times in the past when Roger thought that he might be near the end, and Chaz had kind of willed him to come back from that and survive it, and he did and had done it numerous times. So in some ways it was hard to know, and as someone like myself who had never been privy to those times before, it was hard for me to know, and frankly, it was hard for Chaz to know if this was indeed just another, you know, obstacle to be surmounted, and that Roger would live on, or whether this was indeed the last chapter, as it were. I think it wasn't until very late in the day that it became really clear to Chaz that this time it was different.
One example of the struggles that we're seeing in the last months of his life, there's a scene when he's returning home from the hospital, and he's not in a very good place. He doesn't feel well. He doesn't want to get out of his wheelchair to go up a flight of stairs, and he's motioning for his notebook and visibly, you know, arguing with Chaz. It's a very real moment. And, you know, how, did you feel uncomfortable doing the scene?
Well, you know, I was shooting that day, and I was behind them, as you see when you see the scene unfold. You are viewing all of it from behind them, from behind Chaz and Roger, as they're in this very tight doorway leading up to the steps. And yes, it was very uncomfortable to film. It's just like it was uncomfortable for them to go through it, you know, camera or no camera. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, they might at any moment kind of turn around to me and say, Steve, stop shooting, you know, just stop. And I would have, you know, I would have stopped, of course, and understood that. But they didn't. And I think they partly didn't because they were in the middle of it, and it was a tense moment for them, and I was behind them. And so to some degree, I think they kind of forgot about me because they had more important matters to attend to, which was this, you know, this disagreement over how to navigate the stairs. But I think way to their credit, they never once after that said to me, you know, that day you filmed, you know, does that need to be in the movie? You know, they never once came back and asked that. At one point, months down the road, as I was nearing completion of an edit on the film, Chaz asked me if that scene was in the movie, and I said yes, and she said, I kind of figured it was. And that's it, you know, and I think that's, again, to their credit, because I think it was a hard thing. But as Chaz talks about it in the film, when I interviewed her later and asked her specifically about that moment, she talks about how it's important for people to see that kind of struggle, that that's a kind of struggle that everybody goes through in situations like that. And she's aware that a lot of people have this perception of, or had this perception of Chaz and Roger as sort of like the perfect couple, you know, that they would never have those kind of struggles. They were so much in love with each other. And it's true, they were so much in love with each other, but that doesn't prevent any couple from having those hard moments. And so I think it's great, and they think it's great, or, you know, that kind of moment was in the movie. It's an important moment, I think, for people to see.
I want to switch gears a bit and talk about some of the other memories we hear from people in the film about Roger. You specifically confront his history with women in the film.
Roger has always been attracted to weird types. I mean, you should see some of the women that he's hauled into O'Rourke's over the years. You know.
Back in the old days, Roger had probably the worst taste in women of any man I've ever known. They were either gold diggers, opportunists, or psychos.
Yeah, I met Roger one time with a woman that looked like a young Linda Ronstadt. And when she was gone from the table briefly, I said, who is that? And he said, she's a hired lady. And I said, a hooker?
Do you have a favorite story from that?
Well, you know, I don't have a favorite story, you know, of a actual woman per se. I mean, you know, I think because, frankly, you know, the guys didn't get into the chapter and verse on it. You know, Roger talks about some of this, his, you know, dating days in his memoir. But I do like the story that Bill Knack, who met Roger in college and remained lifelong friends with him, that Bill Knack talks about when he met up with Roger one time, and Roger was with a hired lady, and he was kind of surprised that Roger, you know, was with a prostitute. You know, I think in part because Roger at that time in his life was not having a hard time getting dates. You know, he was by that point he was a Pulitzer Prize winning film critic, and he was a popular guy. But Roger was an adventurer. You know, I think that's one thing that comes through in his memoir, and I hopefully in the film is that he really did kind of embrace life in a very full way. As John McHugh, his lifelong friend, said, he loved characters. He loved people that were really fascinating and interesting. And I suspect that spread to his dating life as well.
Speaking of Roger's history with women, Chaz makes a correction to the story of how she and Roger met
The first time he actually saw me was at an AA meeting.
What do you think made her want to talk about that now?
That's probably a better question for Chaz. It's a little bit more precisely, they actually really first met in a restaurant, the way Roger tells it in the memoir, where he was with Ann Landers and he saw her across the room and engineered a meeting, and he was immediately, it seems, smitten with her. But what Chaz talks about in the film is how they actually first saw each other at an AA meeting. That Roger was there, she was there, but they actually didn't meet. But they saw each other there, and her choice to share that in the film, even though that had never been shared before, is interesting. I mean, I think I would guess it has something to do with just the sort of candor with which both she and Roger embrace this idea of doing this film. And to reveal that about herself, I thought, was really courageous.
We talked about some difficult, obviously, footage of treatment and portions of, in the last few months of his life. Chaz didn't see the completed version of the film until the screening at Sundance.
Well, she could have seen the completed version before Sundance. I would never spring a film on a main subject. And in fact, I shared a cut of the film with her months before and met with her and heard her thoughts on it, which is something I always do with major subjects in films. I don't give them editorial control, but I want them to see how the film is shaping up fairly late in the game, and so that they can see what I've done with their story, and we can talk about it. And sometimes that process is very straightforward and simple, and there's not much to discuss. Sometimes with some films, it's led to quite a bit of dialogue. In this case, I mean, Chaz had some really interesting thoughts and ideas and questions about choices made, but I think overall she felt good about the film. But she, at a certain point, chose not to see the finished film until the festival because, I think she had seen it in a far enough along stage that she knew what it was going to be,
When she did see it in its early stages then, what was her reaction to it?
Well, she wondered why, since there were so many filmmakers whose Roger's writing had influenced their career, should there be more voices of filmmakers in the film? Like, for example, she said Spike Lee. And I explained to her, yes, Roger's review, particularly of Do the Right Thing, he really championed that film in a big way. And I think and Spike Lee's first film, She's Got to Have It. But I said, there are so many filmmakers who we could interview like that, and that for me, the bar had to be not just filmmakers whose work he had had an impact on, but that he'd also had some kind of more personal relationship with as well, so that they could speak about Roger the person, not just Roger the critic who had written about their films. And she got that. She was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. I mean, those are the kind of things you get from subjects when they're really engaged. They help you. I've never gone through this process and not come out with a film that I thought was better as a result of that back and forth. And I think it's also just a big part of the kind of trust that I strive for with the subjects, so that they feel like, in a way, that I've made the film with them, not on them.
You mentioned the emails and the contacts that Roger and Chaz had in getting these interviews scheduled and asked them to be candid. Would you have gotten some of these interviews if it weren't for their help?
I don't know. I think there's certain people that without Roger's endorsement, they would not have done the interview. I don't know that John McHugh would have consented to be in a documentary if I had written him or called him and said, I'm doing this documentary on Roger. I'm sure the first question would have been, is Roger part of this? And if I'd said, no, we're just doing it on him, I think he very well would have declined. And I think that would have been true of a lot of people, maybe not everyone, certainly. But I think what difference it did make beyond that is that it made a difference in terms of how free they felt to speak candidly. Because a lot of these folks we were interviewing are people that, for whom Roger is a dear, dear person, a person that they admire greatly and in a lot of cases were very close friends with. And you know, as well as I, that when you're interviewing people who are close friends about someone, they're normally going to be trying to just say only the nicest things for a movie. And so I think that's what, you know, that's what was so great about him and Chaz asking people to be candid, because and I think that a lot of these close friends understood, and they had an appreciation like any real close friend, that Roger was a complicated guy, an interesting and complex individual. Richard Corliss, the critic who was probably as close to Roger among other critics as anybody, told me, it's not in the film, but he said at one point, he said, if you interview 100 different people, you'll probably get 100 different sides of who Roger Ebert was.
One of the interviews I thought about and wondered how much encouragement she needed was Marlene Siskel's wife, because she hasn't spoken very much.
Yeah, well, yes. No, I think this may be the first time she's ever really spoken at any length at all publicly about her husband and Roger and that time. And that's, I think, in large measure because she is a very private individual. They were a very private family, you know, and a couple, despite the fact that Jean Siskel was famous, but their home life was very much a private affair and family life. And so, yes, we went to Marlene early enough in this process and just went to lunch with her and talked about the film and talked about the goals of the film. And, you know, I think she just felt like maybe this was the time to do that. I don't think she'll be doing a lot of it going forward. I think she felt a duty to both Gene and Roger to be a part of this. And when we interviewed her, Roger was still alive. So it wasn't like she decided after the fact that she should do it. She made a decision to do it while Roger was very much with us.
I want to talk for a few minutes about Ebert's relationship with Gene Siskel. There are several clips in Life Itself from their television show. You get a definite sense of the impassioned way they would talk about the movies.
Tremendously boring. Boring from beginning of the movie. And I just want to compare this film to The Godfather.
No, wait a minute. Now, he's not boring at all.
Oh, yes. Fabulously boring.
He is fabulously boring.
I wondered, how would you characterize their relationship, and was it hard to capture that?
Well, the relationship between Gene and Roger is one area of the memoir that Roger does not spend a lot of time on. I mean, he does talk a little bit about that they were professional rivals and that they struggled with each other. But it's a much, his account of their relationship is humorous at times and much more sort of, even in some ways, almost sentimental because of the loss of Gene. And I knew, from reading the great oral history of the Siskel and Ebert show that was done by Josh Schollmeyer, who came on board as a co-producer on the film, I knew that there was a lot more to that relationship than what Roger permitted himself to write about in his memoir. And so I knew that one way the film would deviate from the memoir is that we were going to try to dig into that, and the show and that relationship, you know, much more deeply. And, you know, I mean, I didn't know either of them at the time of all that. I mean, I met Roger and Gene very, you know, informally around the time Hoop Dreams came out 20 years ago. But, you know, I was not privy personally to it all, but I certainly interviewed people who were. And what I took away from it is that, you know, Gene Siskel was, next to Chaz, the most significant relationship Roger had in his life. And it was a relationship that had a profound impact on his career and on Gene's career. It was a relationship that fulfilled, on some level, an absence in Roger's life of not having siblings. And with that came all of the competitiveness and angst, but satisfactions that can come from siblings, particularly, I think, among men, especially if they're competing in the same field. And I think that, you know, it was interesting that each of the three producers we interviewed of the show who were there at different times during the lifespan of that show with Gene and Roger, they each individually said they thought they witnessed the transformation from animosity to, you know, a much more positive relationship between the two of them. They each thought they saw that transition happen, and yet they were all there at different times in the relationship of Gene and Roger. And what that said to me is that relationship was always one that was complicated. It was one that was always filled with kind of every emotion imaginable. And even though I do think they evolved to a much more positive place by the end of their, before Gene died, it was not like it was that simple. It wasn't like they started out as enemies and ended up as friends. It was always more complicated than that.
In that short chapter dedicated to Gene Siskel in the memoir, the last quote describes Ebert's feelings towards Siskel. He writes, "How meaningless the hate, how deep the love." Did you get any sense of regret that Roger had early on about that relationship?
You know, at one point in the film, I talk about how I had 9 pages of questions for Roger, right? And I tried to send a whole bunch of them at once, and he was just overwhelmed, needless to say, and he emailed back rather humorously, "I tell you what, Steve, just send me one at a time." I never really got to discuss Gene Siskel directly with Roger in those last 4 months, which may seem odd, but I never really got to talk to him in the present about Gene. So most of what I got from Roger was from what he had written and what others would tell me. I do think from the interviews I've done and the reading of that oral history that I did, I do think that on some level, absolutely, Roger had some regrets about how competitive they had been and at times, you know, to a kind of ridiculous point of competitiveness for grown men, frankly. I think he definitely probably had some regrets and wished they could have gotten past some of that. But I also think on some level he knew that was the secret, you know, alchemy that made them both better critics and made them successful in doing the show. I mean, I think he, you know, you don't argue with people you don't respect, generally, not the way they did. And they both had such tremendous respect for the other, and what they had to say and what they had to offer, that they butted heads frequently. But they also agreed a lot, too. They agreed about films. It was kind of funny. They, you know, often would agree. They might give the film a thumbs up, both of them, but the way in which they would disagree in those situations sometimes is that they would think that their reason for giving it a thumbs up was more important than the other's reason. But I think these two guys realized what they had. And I don't think there was any regrets about having worked together. I think if there were any regrets, it might have been that they possibly could have gotten along a little better at times.
Well, and Siskel and Ebert really changed the face of film criticism with the whole branding of the two thumbs up model. And you know, they were more than just critics. I mean, they really helped further roles for movies like Hoop Dreams and many other small films.
Yes, they were more than critics. They had a greater impact on the culture, and they had, you know, I think they had a greater impact on the way in which more everyday movie lovers look at movies. You know, when you look at the history of film criticism, there are certain titans and icons that stand out, you know, in the literature. But by and large, most of them their appeal was more circumscribed. It was either in academic circles or it was in more rarefied, you know, publications like The New Yorker, you know, Pauline Kael, for example, or Andrew Saris in The Village Voice. And what Roger and Gene did with the show was they brought the idea of smart and at times combative criticism into the mainstream. And so that people watching that show were encouraged to think more deeply about how they felt about a movie beyond just to say, oh, I liked it or I didn't like it. You know, it's in a way, it's a bit of an irony to say, yeah, thumbs up, thumbs down, which they were criticized for, and we talk about that in the film, for criticized by some as reducing film criticism to a simple yes or no. In fact, I don't think that's what they did at all. I think that what they did is they really encouraged people to articulate what they liked or disliked about a movie and defend what they like or disliked about a movie.
Chaz spoke in the movie about how Roger chose to handle his illness publicly, in part because Siskel chose not to. And so did that play a role in some of the footage that Chaz and Roger let you film?
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know that they were thinking about Gene when they agreed to that at that point. I think that decision had long been made before. When Gene had brain cancer, they chose to deal with it in about as private a way possible, especially for someone in the public eye like Gene was. And Roger chose to deal with it in a very different way. And both, in my view, are completely appropriate and honorable ways to deal with, you know, profound illness. And yet, true the form of Gene and Roger, they both chose very different ways to do it. It's almost like it was an extension of their criticism. I joked, this is of course before Roger passed away, but I joked with some of the interviewees when we were making the film early on that, you know, if Gene were around, they would probably enjoy having a debate on the proper way to deal with illness. Now, I don't think in reality they would. I think that they would both totally respect the choices that he made. But there's no question that the way Gene dealt with it influenced Roger. The level of candor, though, that Roger and Chaz allowed for in the film, in my view, goes beyond anything that Roger had done up till now. You know, Roger had been out in public and been very brave about letting people see him. But there's a difference between Roger appearing in public at an event and Roger in a hospital bed. And I hope people listening don't think, oh, I don't want to see that film if that's what you're going to show me, because I think you'd be really missing a chance to sort of peek behind the curtain of the private Roger. And I found the private Roger no less admirable and courageous than the public Roger.
Well, we talked a lot about filmmakers, but, you know, Ebert, in his days at the U of I, was originally a newspaper man, and one of the first people we see in this movie is Bill Nack, and they were originally friends from his days at the Daily Illini. So how did you think his background as a newsman influenced his career as a film critic?
I think that's a great question. I think for Roger, he always thought of himself as a newsman, and he had the kind of same sort of discipline throughout his career that he first learned and mastered as a newsman, which is you do the work, you do it daily, you do it on time, you get it in, and then you move on to the next one. You know, you move on to the next film just like you might move on to the next story. And, you know, I think that Roger's engagement and interest in the world at large, you know, he didn't grow up wanting to be a film critic. He grew up wanting to be a novelist, by way of first being a newspaper man and then maybe being a like an op-ed writer. You know, I think if he was going to chart his own career path early on, that would have been the path, not film criticism, even though he loved movies. And so the movie criticism job fell in his lap, and he seized on it and made it his own, but I think he always brought to bear those sort of journalistic instincts. He didn't have a problem using the movie as a springboard to speak about politics or about social issues. And he had, again, that kind of discipline and that kind of, he sort of mastered that kind of Midwestern newspaper writing style, the best of that style, in his reviewing. His reviews weren't highfalutin and full of obscure quotes and flowery language. He wrote very directly, beautifully, and clearly, which is what I think kind of every journalist wants to do.
The very first thing we hear in this movie is a clip from Roger Ebert, which I assume was maybe early 2000s after he had his initial surgeries, and he said movies were a machine that generates empathy. Is that what this movie is about?
I hope so. I love that quote because I think he that was at his dedication of his star at Chicago Theater. So that was like in 2005. And I just think he hit the nail on the head in terms of what movies are at their best. And it's you know, what he articulates there, I think, is what I, even though I hadn't articulated it before hearing it from him, it's, you know, it's what I've been trying to do as a filmmaker my whole career, which is to as certainly as a documentary filmmaker, is to have the viewer walk in someone else's shoes for a while, see their lives fresh and through their eyes, and hopefully not sit in judgment of people's lives, not make easy judgments, but help people understand and empathize with the lives of others. And I think, you know, Roger did that in his criticism, but it was all grounded in his own life. I think he was able to look at his own life and all of the struggles that he went through and the adventures he had, and he translated that experience to the movies.
Who else, is there anyone else we might hear from when this movie is a DVD release, or what else might we see in extra, bonus footage?
Well, just about every single person we interviewed at least appears in the film, but there were certainly a number of other stories, and, you know, great. I mean, I interviewed people, you know, I interviewed nearly two dozen people, and they were long interviews in many cases. So there's lots of other stories that we could include on the DVD. For instance, interviewed at length Roger's colleagues at the Sun-Times, and they only appear very briefly in the movie. They had a lot of great things to say. Roger Simon tells this great, it literally takes 10 minutes to tell the story, a famous story of Roger's where he and McHugh had a bet about that Roger said that, you know, it's this part, first part of this in the film, is that Roger's, when Roger said that he could order two Johnny Walker Blacks anywhere in the world, McHugh took him up on a bet on that. And there's this great Shaggy Dog story, probably about 30% of which is true, of how that went after that. That'll certainly be on the DVD. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff that hopefully will make the DVD something, you know, that people will treasure beyond just having the film.
And you told Matt Zoller's sites on RogerEbert.com, you thought there would be other movies about Roger Ebert, maybe a dramatic film. You know, what else do you think might be part of his legacy and things that have yet to be made?
Absolutely. I mean, I could see, I think you could certainly see a dramatic film, and I know that there was some kind of announcement of there's an attempt to do a film about Rogers and Russ Meyer and the making of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. That could be very interesting. But I also think, you know, there might be a film that delves into, say, Roger the film critic, and that's its exclusive focus. You know, I really tried with this film to kind of get our arms around the man, both as a critic and his personal life, and sort of kind of do it all to whatever degree we could in a single, standalone film. And I feel really good about what we were able to accomplish there, but there's way more detail that could be explored in a guy whose life was this interesting.
Well, Steve James, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And best wishes. When do we expect to see? Obviously, we're all looking forward to the Ebert Fest premiere. When would we expect to see it theatrically released?
It will open theatrically starting in New York, Chicago, and L.A. on July 4th. And then it will go from there. And I fully expect that it will make its way to Champaign-Urbana beyond its premiere at Ebertfest.
I'm Jeff Bossert, and so far this hour on Focus, I've been talking with Steve James, director of the new film Life Itself. James's documentary is based on Roger Ebert's 2011 memoir of the same title. It makes its local premiere Wednesday, April 23rd, at this year's annual Ebert Fest at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I'll talk with Chaz Ebert. Stay with us. This is Focus on WILL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert. This hour on the show, we've been talking about the new documentary about Roger Ebert, Life Itself, which is based on his 2011 memoir. Out of anybody who was invested in the film's production and final cut, we were interested to see if Chaz Ebert gave it a thumbs up or thumbs down. She told me yesterday that she and Roger trusted director Steve James to ensure this film would indeed be an accurate portrayal of his life.
Well, I thought that Steve James did a magnificent job, especially since he had to change the direction that he had planned for the film. When Steve James started the process of filming my husband in December 2012 with the idea that the filming could go on for a year, that he wanted to film us having dinner parties and filming Roger going to the movies and filming Roger still doing his speaking engagements and filming Roger still teaching courses on film and mentoring young film writers and filmmakers as Roger did. However, you know, I guess God had a different plan, and on April 4th, Roger passed away. So Steve had to change the whole trajectory of the film.
With that, with the focus of the film changing, there are a lot of shots that are hard to watch. Was there ever a moment in the movie when you wanted to ask Steve James, you know, cut this part out?
Yes, of course there were. But, you know, Roger and I both believe firmly that when we opened up the process, when we gave the approval for Life Itself to be filmed, we didn't want to be coy about it. We trusted Steve James as a filmmaker. He was a fine documentary filmmaker. He made Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters and a lot of other films in between. And so we trusted his judgment and his integrity as a filmmaker.
It was important for you and Roger, for those to be interviewed. You told them to please be candid. You helped Steve, the two of you helped Steve reach out to some folks. Was there anyone at first that didn't want to be part of the project?
No. No. Everyone was very happy to be part of the, as far as I know. I mean, if anybody had any qualms about it, they would have told Steve. They probably wouldn't have told me. But, you know, people loved Roger. Roger was so authentic, and he was who he appeared to be. And people got that. And so I think they were genuinely happy to contribute and do what they could.
You had the experience of watching Life Itself. I'm sure you'd seen scenes, but the first time with an audience was at Sundance. Have you thought about what it'll be like to watch it in Roger's own home community?
Oh, wow. Just asking that question makes my heart, I feel a little palpitation because I am so excited that we will be able to show it to the Ebert Fest crowd, a place this is the 16th year of Ebert Fest, and even though Roger passed away shortly before the 15th year, he had programmed the entire festival last year. Even, you know, his spirit was just very, very present in every single movie we watched last year. And I think this year, starting off with Roger, is so powerful to me. I think it's going to be so emotional for everyone, and I think it's the way to start the festival. The festival is Roger, so I'm just really happy. I'm sorry that you're even recording this because I'm being so inarticulate, but I'm so excited that we're starting the festival with life itself.
Yeah, you mentioned in a writing that the audience at Sundance was kind of like a protective shield in the energy of all the people, and I assume you feel that way about more of that when you're going to be in Champaign-Urbana.
Even more so because this is his festival.
So how are you feeling just overall about the festival, making final preparations for Ebertfest and coming down here next week?
I'm buoyant because I know that Roger would be so pleased with the selections of film. You know, it's the 25th anniversary of Do the Right Thing, and Spike Lee will be there in this. The 25th anniversary of Born on the 4th of July, and Oliver Stone will be there. Steve James will be there with Life Itself. Ramin Barani, this is his third film at the festival, will be there with Goodbye Solo. These are all films that Roger gave 4 stars to and that meant a lot to him. Roger and Nate and I used to sit down and talk about different films that we would want at the festival. And if we decided for whatever reason not to schedule it for that year, we put it on the list. And so over a period of about 14 or 15 years, we've collected enough films on the list to have the festival for the next 10 years. It's just a joyous feeling to be able to continue his film festival.
Speaking of films and his favorite films or films that he hasn't seen, on the RogerEbert.com website, I think it was on Christmas Day, you had a list of movies that you felt Roger would have really liked. Do you hear his voice in your head when you're watching a movie now?
I do. Not only do I hear his voice in my head, sometimes I turn my head to look next to me, and I expect to see him sitting there. And of course he's not, but I just, you know, because we watched movies together for 23, 24 years, it's almost impossible to think about films without thinking about Roger. And he was, you know, and he actually was a critic for 46 years, so I could imagine that for his readers or the viewers of the TV show, that it's almost impossible. For those who followed him for 46 years, it's probably impossible for them to think about movies without thinking about Roger, and I understand that. I just did not know that I would feel the same way because I was also his wife, and so I had a different relationship with him, but I was also a fan of his, just like everyone else.
I know in the blog on the Ebert site, you mentioned talking about Life Itself and the film and the book being kind of episodic portions of Roger's life. Is there anything that got left out?
Oh, there's a lot that got left out because Roger had a very full life. Roger was, he was a Renaissance man. He did so many things. I mean, he sketched and he painted and he was a grandfather and he was a teacher. And there are lots of things that he did that they wouldn't have been able to print the book if it had contained everything. So, of course, there are lots of things that were left out.
You sound really excited about the schedule for the whole festival this year, as I'm sure you have been. And so are you settling into the role of executive producer and host for Ebertfest and making it continue for many more years?
Yes. You know, Roger, I think, he lost his ability to speak physically in 2006. So I've been a co-host of the festival from the very beginning when it first started 16 years ago. So I just had to take a bigger role as Roger lost his ability to speak. And so this is not a new role for me. The newness of it is not having my husband there.
The title of the film, Life Itself, taken from the memoir, the book was a guide for the film. What does the title mean to you now that he's gone?
Well, the title, do you know that the title came from a letter, came from Studs Terkel?
Right.
Yeah. And Studs Terkel talked about how after Roger lost his ability to speak physically, that his writing became so deep and rich and so profound about films and politics and life itself. That's sort of a paraphrase of the letter from Studs Terkel, and that's where Roger took the title of the for his memoir from. And I think it really says it all.
All right. Well, Chaz, it's been great talking with you. Chaz Ebert, appreciate your time. Safe travels. Look forward to having you back down here.
Thank you.
I'm Jeff Bossert, and you've been listening to Focus on WILL. This hour, I talk with Steve James, director of the new film Life Itself, and Roger's wife, Chaz Ebert. The film, which is based on Ebert's 2011 memoir of the same title, makes its local premiere on Wednesday, April 23rd, at this year's 16th annual Ebert Fest in Champaign. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. You can also find a preview of Steve James's new film on the page where you can find a download for this episode of Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert. Thanks for joining us.